This is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing. I get all of these diversified type books. I get romances, I get biographies, I get all types of books, and I am so thrilled when I get something that just opens my mind to something that I didn't know about. And that's why I'm really excited to be talking to Gretchen Charrington in a little while. And here she is. She's on. Gretchen, are you there?
I am here. Can
you
hear
me? Oh, thank goodness. I couldn't take it again, Gretchen. I lost you.
I'm so sorry. Oh, gosh. Anyway, here we are.
Okay, here we are finally. So, I was just going to start telling people about you. I could have done a whole half hour just talking about you because you're so interesting. But I did want to talk about this book. So, again.
Thank you.
Gretchen Charrington is on, and the name of her book is The Butcher, The Embezzler, and The Fall Guy, a family memoir of scandal and greed in the meat industry. Now, I will tell you, Gretchen, I think, you know, first of all, when you were on before and we talked about a different book, you know, I was thrilled with that because it was about poetry. And I remember telling you at the time that you are such a great writer. You know, sometimes when I get a memoir, that's it. You know, I never hear from the author again. They write one memoir about their family, and that's it. I never hear. But when I read that one, and I said to myself, oh, my goodness, she's so good. She's just such a great writer. I hope she's going to write, you know, a novel, anything. Because you know, when you're that good, you want it to continue. But and
well, I was right.
I said, boy, oh boy. You know, after Poetic License, which was basically a story about your father, who was a very famous poet.
Right.
But after that, I was so happy. You have a really colorful family, so you're lucky.
I do.
You know, my grandparents, well, they were absolutely wonderful people, but they didn't do anything.
Well, that might have been a happier childhood for you. Who knows?
Oh, but you got a heck of a family. And this one, I love the title, The Butcher, The Embezzler, and The Fall Guy.
Thank you.
I'm going to let you tell people about this story, but before you came on, I was going to tell all the cozy mystery authors out there. Sometimes cozy mystery authors concentrate on cozy mysteries. They read cozy mystery after cozy mystery after cozy mystery.
Right.
And they're all the same then.
Yeah.
Mystery authors really need to, you know, you can read 50 of them. And after that, start reading nonfiction. Because as I'm reading this book, I kept coming out with sort of sideline mysteries I could have written. Based on your research of your... Tell us about your family.
You want me to tell you about the book? Is that what you said?
Yeah, tell about the book.
Okay. Okay, well, the book entails, in a sense, a character study of three powerful men, one of whom was my paternal grandfather, Alfred LaRue Eberhardt. The first one, the butcher, is George Hormel, who started what is now the $12 billion conglomerate Hormel Foods. And the embezzler is a man named Ransom J. Thompson, who worked with my grandfather and George Hormel for the first 20 years of the Hormel Company's existence. So it's a character study of these three men, but within the 20-year period that they worked together, the comptroller, Ransom Thompson, I mean, quite a name anyway, right, for an embezzler, Ransom J. Thompson. Anyway, during about a 10-year period, he embezzled nearly $1.2 million from the Hormel Company. That was between about 1910 and 1920. And when the embezzlement was discovered, it sent the company into shockwaves. The company, in a sense, was in default of its loans at that point. It couldn't pay back its loans to the banks that it owed money to. The company nearly went under, and if it had, probably 1,000 to 1,500 employees would have obviously lost their jobs, mortgages wouldn't have been paid, families would have been destroyed. And so in the wake of this embezzlement, my grandfather's great wealth at the time was mostly tied up in in Hormel Company stock. And he unfortunately lost that stock after the embezzlement, which was required back from him when he was forced to resign. There's complexity to this story. However, the main plot is really about these three men, how they build the Hormel Company from 1900 to 1922, when my grandfather is fired, and the embezzlement that takes place. And the question is, was my grandfather complicit in the embezzlement? I had heard, of course, growing up, that he had nothing to do with the embezzlement, and that he was completely innocent, and that George Hormel was, you know, a mean guy for firing him after 20 great years of service in which he helped build the company to a national brand. But I'd also heard that George Hormel was, you know, he also was kind of an amazing entrepreneur for his time. And at the time, I was working with CEOs, and I knew that not all of them were perfect, that they all had their flaws, and also their great strengths. And so I was really intrigued to sort of understand what really happened, whether my grandfather was involved in this at all or not, and how this company really was proclaimed to be too big to fail by its bankers and given a chance to survive. At the same time, my grandfather was not given the same chance to survive financially and basically lost most of his wealth, which frankly would have been about $200 million today. So, you know, if we'd all inherited that through several generations, I might not be talking to you this morning, but I also wouldn't have had this great story to write. So that's kind of a quick summary of the story.
Yeah, you'd be on some fancy island.
Right, exactly.
with a butler serving you on a silver platter.
Right.
Exactly. Yeah, well, that's it. But instead, I think you're still in Minnesota, yeah?
I'm not in Minnesota now.
No, not anymore?
No, I was in Minnesota 2 weeks ago for my launch, and I had made three trips out there when I was doing the research for the book, and then went out 2 weeks ago for a very large event, which was just so fun to be back there 25 years later from when I had last been there. So, well, no, I'm currently calling you from the state of Maine.
Okay. Well, now explain this area, because most people don't realize, you know, Minnesota has a lot of things going for it besides Hormel, also 3M. So explain this atmosphere that existed. You know, I'm from northern Michigan.
That's right.
Up there, you know, I'm a Youper. We're sort of considered, you know, Youpers are a little bit like this, and we talk a little bit like this.
and we
all with that Minnesota, we don't know those people over there because don't understand that they're not the same kind of people.
Exactly. So I'll tell you a little bit about the place. I mean, you obviously know it, but for your listeners, this is the very southern part of Minnesota where Austin is, and that's the corporate headquarters for the Hormel Foods still today. And it was certainly where it was founded in, you know, about 1898 or so. My grandfather started working for George Hormel in 1901. And during that time, but still today, even 2 weeks ago, it is a breathtakingly beautiful part of the country. It is rolling farmland as far as the eye can see. It's sort of like looking at the Atlantic Ocean. There is nothing in front of you but soybeans, let's say, or wheat, or whatever it is that happens to be growing, oats at this particular time of year. And it's beautiful. It's so different from New England, where I was raised and live. I really kind of fell in love with the land, and I think my grandfather did as well. He had been working for George Swift at Swift & Company, the big meat packing company back then in Chicago. And I wondered about what could have attracted him to this sort of backwater little town in southern Minnesota when he was working with the biggest meat packing company probably in the world at the time. And I think some of it was the land. He was a great enthusiast for the outdoors and the wild. And while it was wild in its way, it was simply beautiful, you know, with many beautiful, prosperous farms dotting it. I don't know whether you were trying to do this with your dialect, but largely back then was sort of settled by Danes and Swedes and Germans. And George Hormel was a German whose family moved from Buffalo to Toledo, Ohio. He was one of 12 children. He learned a lot of stiff lessons growing up, very poor. His father owned a tannery. At the age of 10, he was skinning the hides off of hog. I have a 10-year-old granddaughter. It's hard for me to connect such a thing. Not because of gender, you know, just because of age. And but he grew up fast. He left school at 10. He left home at 13. And he, too, fell in love with Southern Plains of Minnesota. So he settled in Austin and decided to open up a small meat market, really, first, and then wanted to become a meat packer because he felt that was an elevated position from a butcher. He didn't want to be a butcher all his life. He wanted to be a meat packer. They would wear suits to work, and other people, mostly men, would do the hard labor, you know, in the meat packing plant. So he recruited my grandfather into that beautiful place. It was then, in 1900, about a small city of about 4,000 people with muddy Main Street, 13 saloons. You know, my grandfather at the time was heading up the Swift offices in St. Paul, 160,000 people with trams and beautiful broad streets. And again, it was a risk that he took, I think, to take the opportunity with George Hormel. But on the other hand, he was made executive vice president of the company, which is sort of second in command, and he was given a seat on the board, the only non-family member on that board. So the opportunity was there also for him to really have a great influence, and I think that's also what attracted to him. So that's a little bit about the place. You know, it looks about the same to me now that it did 25 years ago. Hasn't changed much. It's beautiful. Austin itself is a nice, it's probably 22,000 people now or so. Not really much there except for Hormel Foods and the Spam Museum, which is related. So anyway, that's a little bit about the place.
So, you know, this research must have been so much fun for you.
Well, it really was fun, Patrick. I'm glad you mentioned that because it really was. It was probably some of the most fun that I had writing the book was doing the research. And I had two or three things going for me. First of all, George Hormel wrote a wonderful autobiography, and it's actually a great story if any of your listeners are interested in reading about an early entrepreneur in the early part of the 20th century. It's a wonderful read. It wasn't published when I first read it. It now is because several of his grandsons have published it. However, the version that I read is maybe slightly different from the one that's been published, and I'm glad I was able to read his original words. Anyway, I had that. The embezzler, Ransom Josiah Thompson, he also had written an autobiography in prison, where he served 9 years out of a 15-year term for grand larceny, this big embezzlement, which was a national scandal at the time. So I had his autobiography, and, you know, it too was fascinating. I mean, it's there were many times when I thought, wow, I mean, he sounds very normal and just like you or me, basically. Other times I felt like he came across as a sort of megalomaniac, you know, in search of power, which I'm sure that he was. Complicated man. And then I didn't have an autobiography for my grandfather, but my father had in his literary archives at Dartmouth College 4 large cardboard boxes of letters that my grandfather had written and received to and from meat brokers, colleagues, friends around the country. He was very well known nationally in the meat packing industry. And the letters revolved around these last few years of his time with Hormel. So they were perfect for my research. I was able to gain his voice, and I was able to understand him a little better just from, you know, seeing his correspondence. So those were three primary things. Then I made these three trips out there, and I tried to speak with anybody who would talk with me, basically, in Austin, Minnesota, and also in Leroy, Minnesota, which is south, about 45 miles from Austin, just on the Iowa border. That is where the embezzler spent the $1.2 million building first an enormous chicken farm, claimed to be the biggest in the country at the time. I haven't been able to prove that, but many people said that. But turned it into an amusement park over the last, say, 5 or 6 years of his embezzling. He turned it into this vast amusement park.
And I love this story. I just love this story. It's just so, it's so
crazy.
Cool.
It's totally crazy.
It is.
It's in the middle of nowhere. So he gets known throughout Minnesota as a wheeler and dealer. He's the comptroller of George A. Hormel and Company. But on the side, he's sort of running these farms that he owns. And people kind of question, you know, where he's getting the money for this. But he has a good line about his wealthy aunt left him money.
I think it's so good. It's such a really, you know, as I said, this book is, you wouldn't, you know, maybe look at the title and you say, what? You don't expect it to be so much fun. I mean, and you learn so much. And as I said, I kept sort of wanting to do little side stories. I could do a cozy mystery about that. I think it's the work you put into it. People, really, you should get this book. It's you learn so much about American history just from reading this.
Really.
And understanding that period.
And I did.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
And as I said, it's called The Butcher, The Embezzler, and The Fall Guy, A Family Memoir of Scandal and Greed in the Meat Industry. And it's by Gretchen Charrington. And I'm wondering if you have any other relatives you are going to dig up.
No, I think I'm done with my paternal family, in any case.
Oh, well.
And I don't think I would ever write about my mother's family.
Well, you don't know. Dig for some dirt, and you might find it. Because,
as I
said, you know, I mentioned sort of in passing poetic license the story about your father, Richard Eberhard,
yes,
who was a U.S. poet laureate, and I think under Eisenhower and Kennedy, right? Both?
And Kennedy,
yeah.
That's correct.
And Pulitzer Prize, and, you know, there was a lot of, you know, interesting things about him to learn, too. But I had forgotten, and I don't think I know you. We talked about the people who came through your house, but one of the ones that I was wondering, I can't remember how old you were, but did you meet, like, T.S. Eliot?
No, I did not meet T.S. Eliot, no. No, my time started with Robert Frost, basically. I mean, I was 5 when I met Robert Frost, so I knew who he was, I remember him. I met plenty before that, probably when I was 2 or 3, but my era was sort of Robert Frost through Allen Ginsberg to James Dickey. That was sort of the era that I grew up in. And among them, you know, many, many others, Wallace Stevens, and Robert Lowell, and Anne Sexton, Maxine Cumin, Mary Oliver, you name it.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing.
They were all there.
And you write about them in the book. It's called Poetic
First
License.
Book.
So
yes.
I don't. You're not working on a third book yet?
I am actually working
you
on
are.
A third book.
I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. I knew it. I can't let you not work.
And it will be fiction, but it will be about another true crime. So I can't promise when it's going to be out. I haven't got a deadline really yet. I'm enjoying my launch right now, and I'm going to give myself 6 months before I make a commitment to something. But I do have a good story, I think, to tell.
Well,
but it will be a different.
I was going to push you to write because I need you back here. because I mean, you're writing nonfiction, but the way you write, you're so good. I just,
well,
it's like,
thank you, Patty.
I'm like, I'm reading a great novel, and I'm just, I think it's just terrific. I from day one when I started reading your book, I said, oh, this is so good. This is so good. This is so good. And
I really appreciate your support and opportunity to talk to your listeners. And I really appreciate how much you read both of my books. That means a lot to me. So if I have another one out, you will be the first.
Oh, you're going to. Once you find that joy on paper, you can't stop. You'll never stop.
That's true. That's true. I know.
Mary Higgins Clark was going, strong at... When she was 89 years old,
old
the last time she was on my program. So,
wow.
Really? Yeah.
Okay. Gives me some hope.
And in February, I had Eugenia Lovett West was on my program, and we celebrated her 100th birthday.
Wow. Is that right?
And she wrote a mystery about cybercrime. If you're 100 years old you can do research about cybercrime and write a really smart thriller, you can
fabulous.
Do anything. Okay.
Wow. Okay. Well, you've inspired me.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay.
I'm only 72.
decades and decades. So, Gretchen Sherrington, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. You are a joy.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.